Welcome to Whiskey Cast, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 411 for February 9th, 2013. Coming up in a few minutes.
I feel like someone who's won the Oscars, not just been nominated, but won an Oscar. It's really absolutely, I feel overwhelmed by it, to be perfectly frank.
It's been a big week for Middleton master distiller Barry Crockett. He was named this week as the Whiskey Advocate's Lifetime Achievement Award winner, and a couple of days later announced his plans to retire next month after 47 years with Irish Distillers. More with Barry Crockett later on WhiskeyCast In Depth. I'll also have the calendar of events, the comments of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department.
WhiskeyCast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
Let's start off with the week's news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. Maker's Mark is making news this weekend with plans to put less whiskey in its whiskey, so to speak. The distillery in Loretto, Kentucky has been producing at full capacity for years, and even with expansions, still isn't producing enough whiskey to meet demand. In an email Saturday to Maker's Mark ambassadors, Maker's Mark Chief Operating Officer Rob Samuels and Chairman Emeritus Bill Samuels Jr. announced plans to reduce the alcohol by volume strength of Maker's from its original 45% down to 42%. They say that will allow them to keep the same taste profile while stretching current supplies to meet demand. It's not clear how soon bottles at the new ABV level will be available. I'll have more on this next time around. Lots of new whiskeys to mention this week. Buffalo Trace released 12 new bourbons in one shot. Of course, it's the latest quarterly batch of Single Oak Project bourbons, and we're halfway through the four-year project now with batch number 8. This set of 12 different casks was produced using the same barrel entry proof and char level and matured in the same warehouse. That leaves the variables being the two recipes with rye and wheat-based mash bills, the size of the grain in the wood staves, and whether the wood came from the top or the bottom half of the tree. This batch will hit retailers later this month, with each case containing one bottle from each of the 12 barrels. Turning now to single casks, Weems Malts has released 4 new ones for the European and Asian markets. The bottlings are named after their taste and aroma. Summer Orchard is a 12-year-old Linkwood cask. Bellowing Embers is a 15-year-old Boonehaven. Mellow Mariner is a 20-year-old cask from Ardmore. And Fruit Bonbons is a 23-year-old Glengarry cask. On the blended scotch front, Cutty Sark made its reputation during Prohibition in the U.S. and is returning to those roots with a new Prohibition Edition whiskey. It celebrates Cutty's 90th anniversary this year, the 80th anniversary of the end of Prohibition in December as well, and will be bottled at 50% ABV, which is much stronger than the regular Cutty Sark expressions. I received a sample of the Prohibition Edition this week, and I'll have tasting notes for it on an upcoming episode. Glenfarclas is releasing a single cask bottling that will only be available at the distillery in Speyside. The cask is unique because it was the final one filled on December 31, 1999, and is being branded as the last of the millennium. It was filled by three generations of the Grant family: George S. Grant, who passed away 3 years later, John L. S. Grant, the current chairman of Glenfarclas, and George S. Grant, John's son, George's grandson, who's currently the distillery's brand ambassador. The last of the Millennium cask is bottled at 56.8% ABV, and once again, it'll only be available in the distillery's shop. Finally, Wyoming Whiskey's second batch will be available later this month. If you heard my reporting in episode 400 from Wyoming when the bourbon made its debut in December, the first 3,000 cases literally sold out within seconds at the state's Liquor Control Office. Another 1,000 cases will be available this month, and the state has changed its allocation system to make sure that every Wyoming bar and retailer that wants Wyoming whiskey gets at least a few bottles. In other news, the Distilled Spirits Council of the U.S. held its annual Economic Outlook briefing in New York City this week. Spirits sales in the U.S. rose about 3% during 2012, while revenues grew by 4.5%, The difference is credited to increasing sales of higher-end spirits, including most whiskeys. DISCA's chief economist David Osgo believes the U.S. spirits market has now recovered from the global economic crisis.
In 2011, we saw some very strong growth. We got back to the kind of growth that you typically see after recession, in a non-recessionary time, where your high-end and super premium products are growing the fastest. We saw that in 2011. We saw it again in 2012. So I would say we're completely recovered.
How are whiskeys doing? As I know you've talked about, in general, the overall growth of the whiskey sector in terms of domestic sales first, and then let's talk about exports of the American product. But where are we seeing the growth in the whiskey sector within the U.S., first of all?
Well, the strongest growth that we're seeing right now in the largest category is in bourbon and Tennessee whiskey, where volumes were up over 5%. Now, that being the case, you're also continue to see very strong growth in scotches, particularly single malts, where growth was up around 13-14%. And, of course, Irish whiskey as well. If you're Irish whiskey, it's almost become a boring story for them, but they're growing by over 20% again this year.
And we're talking about them growing from a much smaller base than bourbons and Tennessee whiskeys, which puts that in perspective with the 14% growth in bourbon and Tennessee whiskey, right?
That's certainly true. When we look at the total volume for Irish whiskey, it's a little over 2 million cases, whereas bourbon and Tennessee is up around 16 million. With regard to Canadian whiskey, you're seeing growth in the higher-end products, which is what you would expect. Obviously, Canadian whiskey competes with bourbon and Tennessee whiskey. Given the strong growth that we saw in the value and premium bourbon and Tennessee whiskeys, it might have cut into the growth in Canadian whiskey a little bit. But when you look at their high-end and super premium products, they're doing quite well.
By the way, while sales of world whiskeys in the U.S. are growing, the numbers are still far too small to be broken out on their own. And speaking of the international market, U.S. whiskeys accounted for 68% of a record $1.5 billion in spirits exports during 2012.
In the major markets, we're seeing some really fantastic growth in Canada, our neighbor just to the north. They're up over 200%, and Australia as well. There's always been a fairly large market in Canada for U.S. whiskeys, but it's up again over 200%. And France has also grown by over 200%. When we look at the Netherlands, their sales are up over 400%, albeit from a fairly small base. If we look at the emerging markets, Singapore is up over 900%. Latvia, clearly not a very large market, is up 2,900%. But even when you look at some fairly large markets, you're also seeing some fast growth. Brazil is up 73%. Looking at Korea, they're up 276%. And the Hong Kong market is up over 400%.
Let's talk about the craft movement. Let's move over there because I know you've been doing a lot of research on the craft sector. And you probably have as good a research, or at least in terms of going through the TTB data, as anybody does. Put it in perspective for us. Just how much has the craft distilling sector, especially in the whiskey space, grown over the last couple of years?
Sure. Well, in the last 2.5 years, looking at the guys that, in fact, are out there bottling product for the marketplace, it's doubled. It's grown from around 90 craft distillers to 180 just in the last 2.5 years. Now, in terms of volume, well, by definition, they're craft distillers. They're small guys right now. In calendar year 2010, they sold around 700,000 9-liter cases. Well, by roughly 2012, they're selling at a pace of about 1.2 million 9-liter cases. So we're seeing a lot of very, very rapid growth. It's still less than 1% of the market, but they are growing quickly.
And they're forcing the bigger boys to at least consider them and take them more seriously in the market, right?
Well, we see the craft distillers, the fact that we've craft distiller market has developed in the United States as a sign of strength across the entire spirits industry. Anytime you have growth, the kind of growth we've seen in the last couple of years, it allows for the development of niche players. So ultimately, the development of a craft distiller movement in the United States is a good sign for us.
And because I know I'm going to hear from the folks at ADI when they hear your comments in this interview, you get the number of 180 in terms of distilleries that are actually producing bottled product from the TTB and not operating distilleries that are still in the process of aging spirit and haven't actually bottled anything, right? I know because ADI cites over 200-some distilleries in the U.S.
Yes, that's correct. Obviously, there are different ways to measure the number of craft distillers out there. I know there are a lot of gentlemen that have entered the marketplace. They're developing product. I'm sure it's going to be exceptional product once it comes out. But right now, looking at the number of distillers that are actually bottling for U.S. Domestic consumption, it's 180.
By the way, one of the biggest reasons being cited for increased spirits sales in the U.S. is the increase of so-called flavored spirits. 4 out of 10 spirits have some sort of added flavoring, and Discus added up 220 different flavorings across all spirits. Fortunately, the whiskey producers have managed to stick to a handful of them. Personally, I have no desire to try whipped cream-flavored whiskey. Back to the craft distillers for just a second. New Jersey is one of only 2 states that doesn't have a licensed craft distillery, along with Alabama. That did change this week when Jersey Artisan Distilling in Fairfield, New Jersey, got its state license and began producing rum. They plan to start making whiskey using New Jersey-grown corn by 2015. A second micro-distillery in Camden has its federal license, but is still waiting for a state license to be approved, and the state legislature is considering a bill to make it easier for craft distillers to go into business. Diageo is investing more money in Scotland, but this time around it's not building a new distillery. Instead, it's spending money to preserve its history. The company wants to spend about $2.5 million to expand its archives in Menstrie, with additional storage space and a new library. The archive holds samples of all of Diageo's whiskies and other spirits, along with historical records and memorabilia, and it supplies most of the exhibit materials for the distillery visitors' centers. The archive is not open to the public, but if you want to find out more about it, check the WhiskeyCast archives for episode 325 from July of 2011 and my conversation with Diageo archivist Joanne McCutcher. And finally, if you're visiting New York City and you like to order your whiskey neat like I do, make sure you take a good look at the bill. Bloomberg Businessweek reports some bars in New York City are actually charging more when you order a whiskey neat. As much as a couple of dollars more. That's even though you're not having ice or anything else added to it that might actually cost something. The guiltiest party appears to be the BLT-themed restaurants, where a manager told Bloomberg Businessweek's reporter that they pour more whiskey in the glass when it's served neat, and that it's common practice to charge for a neat pour. Well, I've never seen it happen in New York, and if I ever do see it, I guarantee you it'll be the last drink I order in that bar. If it happens to you, don't take it lying down, and maybe we can make that neat charge just go away. A bit of commentary there, but that's the week's news.
The news is brought to you by Glenmorangie. Visit us on the web at glenmorangie.com or download our iPad app at the iTunes App Store. Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well made.
Let's look at the comments of the week now, brought to you this time around by Johnny Walker. I mentioned this week on Facebook that I was killing time in the State Department's Philadelphia passport office, waiting to get some more pages added to my passport, since it was full and I needed room for a visa. A few perceptive listeners put two and two together and asked if I was planning a trip to Amrut Distillery in India. Well, I have been invited to visit the distillery in Bangalore, but the plans are not set in stone yet. Since I'm a journalist, India requires that I have a special visa to enter the country, as well as extra permits to do little things like record audio and shoot video. I have submitted all of the applications and hope to have an answer from the Indian government soon. I'll keep you posted. In the meantime, I mentioned the Glenfarclas Millennium Bottling on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page, too. That brought a few responses. Danny Williamson's was short and sweet. Here's what he had to say. Yay, I'm going to the distillery next week. That's good timing, Danny. Also mentioned Barry Crockett's Lifetime Achievement Award from Whiskey Advocate on the Facebook page. Adam England commented, amazing story from a man who has brought many smiles over a dram of excellent Irish whiskey, or two. And Hugh Morris commented, I have a bottle of that single pot, kind of waiting for an occasion to open it. Folks, don't wait for special occasions to open a special whiskey with your friends or family. Time's just too short. And opening a special whiskey with some friends might just make that special occasion. Doug Stone at ForWhiskeyLovers.com posted a note on the Facebook page as well. For Whiskey Lovers is presenting the Drammies Awards again this year. The deadline for nominations is coming up on February 15th. Voting will follow once the nominations are announced. There is a category for Best Whiskey Information Source, and if you'd like to nominate WhiskeyCast, I'd appreciate your support, even though awards aren't really what motivates me. Emails do motivate me, though, and if you have something you'd like to share with whiskey lovers around the world, I'd love to hear from you. My email address is comments@whiskeycast.com, and the comments of the week are brought to you this week by Johnny Walker. Valentine's Day is this week. Instead of wasting money on a card, why not have your message of love engraved on a bottle of Johnny Walker Blue Label instead? Check with your local retailer for engraving options or visit johnnywalker.com for more details. Let's check the calendar of events now, brought to you by Laphroaig. The Highlander Whiskey Festival is this coming weekend in Alkmaar, the Netherlands. Whiskies of the World will host a distiller's dinner with Chip Tate of Balcones Distillery at Dixie in San Francisco, February 21st. The Winnipeg Whiskey Festival is coming up February 22nd in Winnipeg, Manitoba, followed by the Spirits of Kingston Whiskey Festival the next day in Kingston, Ontario. Former Glenfiddich brand ambassador Heather Green is now running whiskey schools at the Flatiron Room in New York City. She has a rye whiskey class coming up February 26th and a blind tasting of bourbons planned for March 26th. Rumor has it a Pappy Van Winkle might be one of those whiskeys. The Universal Whiskey Experience is March 2nd and 3rd in Las Vegas, and the Whiskey Classic will be on March 7th in Morristown, New Jersey. Finally, tickets are still available for Whiskey Live New York on April 3rd. Those are just some of the events coming up over the next few weeks. You'll find a complete calendar at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig. Take a virtual distillery tour at laphroaig.com, and while you're there, become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Islay.
WhiskeyCast, brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Billy Lighton, Master Blender, Redbreast single pot still Irish whiskey.
The sherry butts in particular have a big impact on the flavour of Redbreast. It gives it the deep, dried, fruity notes, which is probably the signature of Redbreast. Take a sip, hold it in my mouth for minutes, and just dissect it and pick up all the little fruity notes. There's something that I didn't notice before. Whenever you leave your glass of Redbreast sitting there for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, you can go back to it and go, wow, something's changed there. Why is that changing? How is it changing? Is this something that I should be picking up on, you know? It's fascinating. And, I mean, I've been in the business 34 years and it still excites me, you know, things like this.
Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Those in the know Redbreast.
WhiskeyCast In Depth is brought to you by Woodford Reserve. Part of what makes whiskey interesting is the family connections that tie generations of distilling families together. Kentucky has the Beams, the Russells, the Samuelses, and the like. Scotland has any number of second, third, even fourth generation distilling families. But Ireland has just one now, and next month, that will change. Barry Crockett will be retiring as master distiller at Middleton in County Cork after 47 years working at the distillery. And one could really say he's been there for 65 years, since his father was the master distiller before him and he was born in the distiller's cottage at Middleton. A few days ago, Barry Crockett was honored with Whiskey Advocate's Lifetime Achievement Award.
Well, I must say that I've just, it's only beginning to actually really hit me, as they say. And honestly, I feel like someone who's won the Oscars, not just been nominated, but won an Oscar. It's really absolutely, I feel overwhelmed by it, to be perfectly frank.
What did you think when they told you that you had been named this year's Lifetime Achievement Award winner?
Just overawed, I must honestly say. I can honestly say that I've met John on a few occasions, and he's a real, very nice gentleman. And knowing that the people who have been selected in various other annual awards, they're really icons of the industry, and to be regarded as in the same field as those is just overpowering, really.
And you decided to hang it up right after that and announce your retirement, essentially, right?
Well, my retirement is coming up anyway, Mark, because I'll actually be 65 in next month.
So this was sort of mandated, essentially, right?
Yes, indeed.
But now that you're winding down at the end of a very long career, tell me about some of the highlights of that you're going to leave behind when you finally drive out of Middleton for the final time.
Well, the highlights, I suppose, really, that I would see in the Irish whiskey industry and in the life of Irish distillers is the building of the present Middleton Distillery, which, as you know, you've seen yourself. That was a truly transformative decision to take. And in my career, it was an absolutely splendid opportunity to become involved in the commissioning of that. And, of course, to use the flexibility built into that to refashion the world of Irish whiskey. So that was really a marvellous opportunity and really a brilliantly exciting time.
Let's talk about that for a second, because your father was the original master distiller at the New Middleton plant when it opened in 75 or so.
Correct.
And you inherited that from him a few years later on his retirement, and now you're getting ready to open a new expansion at Middleton of your own as you leave.
Absolutely. I mean, it's an amazing coincidence, an absolutely amazing coincidence that next week we will be starting to commission a brand new set of columns, and I'll be there for that, and shortly thereafter we will be commissioning the brand new, what we describe as the garden stillhouse, the new extension to the distillation capacity of the distillery. And it's truly an amazing coincidence that just as I'm about to retire, this, shall we say, brand new extension, brand new facility is coming on stream.
You mentioned the flexibility that the distillery has a few minutes ago. And for those who are not familiar with the uniqueness that Middleton has in terms of the combination of the various pot stills and the column stills, please explain for those listeners who aren't familiar just what that flexibility allows you to do.
Well, to put it as straightforwardly as I can, Middleton Distillery is a complex in the sense that we have two separate brewing systems and two quite distinct distillation systems. One is the traditional pot still distillation system, and of course, the tradition appropriate to that still remains. The other is what we describe as the grain whiskey distilling system, and it's through that we distill a range of grain whiskies. Now, just to build on that a little bit, the pot still distilling system enables us to produce the styles of whiskies which are well known in terms of the traditional names, namely the traditional Jameson whiskies, Powers, Gold Label, Powers whiskies, and of course also the Paddy whiskey brand. As far as the advances which have taken place is concerned, well then, the improvements that we've made over the years, and we've always been very open to innovation, have enabled us to utilize the basic principles pertinent to the Irish distilling practice, and to enhance those to engender and create a broader framework of different flavoured distillate types. On the other side of the equation, we have the grain whiskey distillation unit, which in its own right is used to distill a range of grain whiskies, some using maize or corn as a raw material, and more using barley as a raw material. So when we speak about flexibility, we speak about a distilling complex which does not just produce one whiskey or two whiskies, but many whiskies from the one complex. These, of course, then are laid down in a select different types of casks. All of this means that over the years we've been able to enhance the imagery and the quality and the flavour and the taste of our brands. And more recently, of course, in particular, we have launched the single Irish pot still category, which I certainly believe is going to become a really successful story. It's already very successful, but a really successful story in time to come, because it will place Irish whiskey and the Irish possible whiskey category, in my view, in the same category as the single malt concept, which is so well known in Scotland.
I think your colleague Dave Quinn referred to the distilling complex almost as very similar to a musical instrument, that you can get a whole bunch of different notes from the different stills and the different combinations when you are playing those notes to get the whiskey that you want, right?
Well, that's very well put. You can really regard it as a gigantic instrument, wherein by using variances of the different styles of distillation, all of which, of course, are triple distilled in the traditional Jameson manner, but as a distiller, you take a decision to create different flavors by varying the fractions, by varying the cutoff points, by varying the rate and time of the distillation sequence. And all of these factors, which many of which have been handed down from generations, in fact, enable us to, as I said, lay down different styles, different categories, and different flavor profiles for our whiskies in warehouse.
I think this is probably a good time to talk about the new guy, the kid that's taking over for you, Brian Nation.
Oh, yes.
who I know you've been mentoring for a long time and is now going to be the new master distiller. Tell us about Brian and what he brings to the role.
Well, Brian has been with us for well over 10 years. He has a background as a chemical engineer. He has been studying the whiskey business for obviously quite some time now, and I've been his mentor over the last 10 years. Currently, or up to his appointment, his principal job has been involved in the process engineering side of the business, and he has been deeply involved in the design of the expansion. So with myself and a number of others, we've gone to Scotland to oversee the design and the building of the new pot stills. And I think maybe you need to appreciate that the stills, these large copper pot stills, were built in Scotland largely because we don't have any such facility in Ireland that could actually build stills of that size. Equally, as far as the column stills are concerned, Brian and myself and a number of others have been several times to Germany to speak to the design engineers over there to outline precisely what we want in terms of the design of those columns. So, in essence, Brian has been deeply immersed in the design work for the expansion, and at the same time, it has been absorbing the ongoing development of the, shall we say, with the current distillery in terms of how one carries out different styles of distillation techniques. So he is actually very eminently suitable to take over as master distiller.
But speaking for the whiskey connoisseurs around the world, does he have the whiskey in his blood the same way you do?
No, I'm afraid he doesn't. I'm afraid he doesn't. He's in that sense, he's new to the business.
And I made reference to this earlier, but you succeeded your father.
Correct.
As the master distiller, and you were actually born in the cottage on the grounds.
Yes.
And one thing we never really talked about when we sat down in the cottage a few years ago was how your dad wound up in the business.
Well, I can certainly bring you up to date on that. Basically, my dad was employed by a man by the name of Norbert Murphy. Now, Norbert Murphy was the, what you would describe in the States as the president or chairman of the Cork Distilleries Company. The Cork Distilleries Company had been established in Cork City for, well, going back to about 1800, in the sense that the Murphy family bought out most of the distilling companies in Cork City. So fast forward, as I say, to the 1920s, 1930s, my father was employed by Norbert Murphy as a laboratory chemist, and in fact It was my father and Robert Murphy who developed initially and improved Cork dry gin in what was then known as the Watercourse Distillery in Cork City. So that distillery was purely a gin distillery, and also it had a yeast factory attached to that. So it produced a baker's yeast for the baking business, and as I said, produced Nutrispirit and Cork Dry Gin. So then, as you know, the precise date, but would think it would have been in probably about 1944, 1943. My father was appointed head distiller. Again, he was quite young at the stage, about 30 or 31. He became head distiller of the old Middleton Distillery and remained in that position until he retired in 1974, 75.
And that's the distillery that people can tour now as part of the Jameson Experience.
Correct.
But it's not the actual production distillery, which is up the hill where you've been working since the 1970s.
Correct, yes. So that old distillery is open. It's actually a very, very important, I suppose, industrial heritage site. And it tells the full story of the original old distillery, and luckily most of the old equipment is still actually on site there.
What was it like growing up there back in the day when that was a working plant every day?
Well, you've got to cast your mind back to the sort of mid-1960s, and you can imagine that certainly in the case of Ireland at that stage, there really was very little economic development. Ireland was still, at that point, very much an agricultural-based country. So things were at a much slower pace than is currently the case, for obvious reasons. But the distilling business was very much a family-type operation. Most of the people working there had fathers and grandfathers in the business. All of the farmers who supplied grain had a very intimate knowledge and knew, you know, the type of grain that they needed to produce. And indeed, when I started work, indeed my very first job was to actually to meet farmers and effectively take samples of their grain and carry out a little analysis before deciding whether or not the grain was adequate for the actual distilling process. So, of course, the plant, in terms of technology, was, I suppose, rather dated. There had been very little investment in distilling in Ireland, I would say, from about 1890, maybe 1900, right up to, obviously, in our case, to 1975. So really, when I started work in the mid to late 1960s, I was really starting to work in a very traditional environment.
And things have changed, as you describe, significantly since for the last several years now, we've seen record growth in Irish whiskey sales every year. And I think it would be foolish to not give you some of the credit for that with some of the whiskeys that you've produced over the years. But what do you see as the reason behind the explosion in Irish whiskey sales and the comeback to, while probably not at pre-prohibition era levels, certainly better than the last 40 to 50 years?
Well, absolutely. The growth rates are a great testament, I think, in the first instance, to a number of factors. One, to the building of the distillery in 1975. That led to the ability to produce better quality whiskies, of course, using the triple distillation method together with the use of barley to give that unique flavor of what I describe as sweet apples and pears, and a soft character, which is most evident in Jameson. I think the second big change, shall we say, took place when Irish Distillers was acquired by Pernod Ricard, and the real benefit of that was that it gained access to markets which up to then were very, very difficult to access. And I suppose the third big change has been the ongoing marketing approach that we've taken, which is to involve the frontline people such as bartenders, restaurant owners, hoteliers, in other words, an ongoing educational approach that we're taking, which indeed is going to advance even further as we're going to later on this year and into next year. So really, I suppose, ultimately, at the end of the day, it is has been our ability to present to the consumer a whiskey which is very appealing in terms of both taste and flavour, to present that in a very fresh and new manner. And of course, ultimately, the choice is always with the consumer. It is clear that the consumer, the whiskey drinker, perceives Jameson as something, I would say, new in many respects, and of course, new in every positive sense. And clearly, the overall real message is that Jameson as a whiskey style is something which I can relate to, and that just doesn't apply in the United States, which is an extraordinarily successful market for Jameson, but indeed other markets such as South Africa, in other words, is a very big market, and indeed other markets such as Russia, and of course we believe that there will be a phenomenal future also in Asia as time progresses.
A couple of years ago, you were honored with the Middleton Barry Crockett Legacy release, which was the first whiskey to be named for a distiller at Irish Distillers and the predecessors, going all the way back to John Jameson. What is the Barry Crockett Legacy going to be, as far as you're concerned? How do you want to be remembered in the industry, since a month from now there won't be a Crockett at Middleton for the first time in 70 years?
Well, there will not be a Crockett in Middleton, certainly for the first time in 70 years, and obviously that's going to be a distinct change. But I think my legacy really is epitomized in the Barry Crockett legacy, because what it means is that the result of all our efforts, and obviously my particular effort, has been to represent Irish whiskey, and particularly the Irish pot still whiskey style, back to a world market. And if you take that as a distinct example, but also take the example of one which is maybe a little bit better known, namely the Redbreast range, I think you can clearly see that there is a very, very strong appeal and a very strong recognition that this Irish pot still style really is something that people aspire to. So I think I would like to think that my legacy is that not just for the first time in 70 years, but for the first time maybe in 100 years, or maybe a little bit more, that Irish whiskey is seen as really top class, and restoring its level of imagery and its level of growth back to what is very, very evident in the sort of 1880s, 1890s.
Barry's retirement party won't take place until September, when Irish Distillers plans a special dinner in his honor during the events to dedicate the Middleton Distillery expansion. That's this week's WhiskeyCast In Depth, brought to you by Woodford Reserve. Welcome the new year with craft and distinction. Visit woodfordreserve.com for cocktail recipes perfect for the occasion. Craft carefully. Drink responsibly. Bourbon whiskey, 45.2% alcohol by volume. Woodford Reserve Distillery, Versailles, Kentucky. The What I'm Tasting This Week department is brought to you by Bal Blair, and I've been tasting a bunch of whiskeys this week. First off, Johnny Walker's two new expressions are not available in the U.S. yet, but the Gold Label Reserve and Platinum Label are available in other countries, and I was able to get samples of both while I was in Canada last month for the Victoria Whiskey Festival. As we heard back in December from Johnny Walker's Stephen Wilson, the Gold Label Reserve replaces the Gold Label 18-year-old in the lineup. Like all Johnny Walker expressions, it's bottled at 40% ABV. The nose is warm and buttery with allspice, honey, and a touch of caramel candy sweetness. The taste is surprisingly spicy, with good cinnamon and cilantro notes, hints of black tea, honey, and lemon underneath, with touches of dark chocolate. The finish has lemony tartness with a lingering cinnamon spice balanced by a bit of honey. It's very long and smooth with a good overall balance, and I'm scoring the Johnny Walker Gold Label Reserve an 89. Meanwhile, the Platinum Label is an all-new expression that replaces the Green Label in most markets, but is not a blended malt as the Green Label is. The nose is creamy and smooth with allspice, touches of smoky oak and roasted almonds, and hints of honey and toffee. The taste is smooth at first with a citrusy tartness that turns into spicy cinnamon, then fades back to subtle lemon peel with honey and black tea notes that last through the finish, which fades rather quickly but leaves touches of cinnamon and licorice on the palate. I'm scoring Johnny Walker Platinum Label an 87. Tasted a sample of the Elijah Craig 20-year-old single-barrel bourbon from Heaven Hill this week. It replaced the 18-year-old version in the lineup last year and is bottled at 45% ABV. The nose is warm, inviting, and spicy, with oak, soft cinnamon, allspice, cocoa, and molasses notes. The taste is tart and spicy with lemon zest, cinnamon, cilantro, and hints of cocoa and brown sugar underneath. The finish is tart and long. I'm scoring the Elijah Craig 20-year-old single-barrel bourbon a 93. I also tasted some of the bourbons from the Willett family at Kentucky Bourbon Distillers this week, including the Noah's Mill 15-year-old bourbon bottled at 57.15% ABV. The nose is aromatic and spicy with a mild burn and touches of allspice, lemon custard, tobacco, and soft vanilla. The taste is full of honey at first, followed by a sharp, biting cinnamon that fades to reveal the honey again with touches of vanilla and caramel that add balance underneath. The finish is short on the tongue, but with aromatic cinnamon and black tea aromas that linger for a while. It's an excellent whiskey. I'm scoring Noah's Mill Bourbon a 93. You'll find tasting notes for these and hundreds of whiskeys at the WhiskeyCast website, and that's also where you'll find links for WhiskeyCast HD and WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings episodes, our Facebook page and my Twitter feed, the calendar of events, the photo gallery and print shop, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is WhiskeyCast.com, and my email address for your questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com.
WhiskeyCast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the Stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2013, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.